the U.S. Congress likes to claim they're going to democratize things. We're going to democratize Cuba. We're going to democratize Nicaragua. I would argue that the only thing we've successfully democratized in Latin America is the drug economy itself. We took out the two big monopolies, and we opened up that space to hundreds of smaller competitors. Some of them family-operated, vertically integrated, much more efficient, each with their own smuggling routes, their own list of officials that they bribe, much harder to infiltrate.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, it's time for the weekly Freak Show for the week ending Saturday, October 27th, 2001. My name is the V-Man, and I'll be your host for this one-hour look back at the features not heard in or glanced over by the corporate-controlled media. On this week's program, freelance journalist David Petorti lost a brother on 9/11. We'll hear how he feels about the war on terrorism. And later, Sanho Tri, drug policy program director of the Institute for Policy Studies, links the war on drugs to the new war on terrorism. Plus, this week's Spotlight Sound. Stand by for the Weekly Freak Show, coming up next. And now this week, a change in format. Due to increasing demands on my personal time, the headlines segment of the Weekly Freak Show is no longer being produced. The amount of news right now is too overwhelming for me to handle, and from now on, this show will serve to offer analysis of world events. Moving on. On October 8th, as most Americans rose concerned and curious about the military action taking place on the other side of the globe, National Public Radio's Morning Edition host Bob Edwards asked Cokie Roberts to weigh in. Leaders of Congress were quick to issue a statement in support of the military action in Afghanistan. Were there any dissenters? None that matter, she replied. So begins an article by freelance journalist David Petorti, authored in mid-October. On September 11th, David's brother James Petorti was in his office on the 96th floor of the World Trade Center when the first plane slammed into the building. I spoke with him recently about his tragic loss and why he came forward to call for peace.
I was standing on the deck outside of my back door. I had just had breakfast and was drinking a cup of coffee, and my wife was holding our 1.5-year-old baby, and the phone rang, and it was my mother, and she was very concerned about this, what she said was like a kamikaze attack on the World Trade Center, and I didn't have any idea what she was talking about. It just came out of nowhere. And I just remember stepping back into the living room, and my wife turned the TV on, and we saw the pictures that you've all seen of those towers, and my mother was saying, you know, your brother works there. And I needed her to jog my memory because my brother used to work in Midtown Manhattan, and it was only recently, I think a couple of years ago, that his office had moved to the 96th floor of One World Trade Center. I was asking my mom if she knew what floor he worked on because I didn't know exactly where he was, and then his wife had called her and said that he worked on the 96th floor. And I kind of looked at that building and I sort of did the math, and my eyes were kind of going up, and I knew it was 110 stories tall, and I just knew that the thing had hit him right where he was. And in fact, we found out several days later that that first plane pretty much just took out about 8 floors of the building, and his floor was one of those floors, so he was just pretty much gone. We hope he was gone instantly as opposed to somebody hanging out of the window or standing on the roof when the building came down. So of all the ways to go, I suppose if you're going to go, you might as well just go in that first big boom.
How have you taken this? How has you and your family taken this tragic event?
Well, my parents are both still alive, and they're both pretty old. Dad is 83 and Mom is 76, and they're very religious people. They're good church-going Catholics. So they got a lot of support from their church community. They still live in the town that my mom grew up in, and they just had a huge amount of support, people coming over with food and visiting. So they were really dug into that community, but obviously they were just in shock, and I was in shock, and my wife was in shock, and my brother's widow, of course, was just freaking out. They had been married for about 13 years, and they were living in Princeton, New Jersey, which is a little ways outside of New York City. What can you say? My God, you know, your husband just doesn't come home, you know, and you're expecting him to come home, and he just doesn't come home. And I remember her telling me that she had to go to the train station to try to get his car. Like a regular commuter, he would drive his car to the train station in the morning at 6:30 and take the train into New York City. And so he just didn't come back. So his car is still sitting at the train station, and she didn't have a key for his car, and I guess she had to get a locksmith to go over, and the locksmith refused to do it because she didn't have ID or something, and she finally had to get the police to open his door so she could drive his car home. So we were all pretty much in shock for a really long time. And it's a really weird situation because it's this really public event and everybody knows about it, but then it's this really private event for us. At the very beginning, it seemed like the whole world was just in shock, and we were in shock, and the whole world was just incredibly upset and excited and wondering what was going on, and we're just in shock. And we're not feeling anything. And now, in the months since then, it feels like everybody's kind of gotten over it, and they're kind of getting on with their lives as much as they can, and we're just beginning to feel it. So we feel like we're just having this delayed reaction of pain, obviously.
Your brother's name is James. Can you talk about your brother, James?
Well, he worked at Marsh McLennan, which is a multinational insurance company, and he was one of many vice presidents. They have a whole bunch of vice presidents. And he was a systems analyst, you know, typical sort of software desk job. I have a lot of mixed feelings about it because it was a big company. I don't feel like they treated him really, really well. I think he had a bunch of friends there, so I wouldn't speak badly of them. But it was like a big company, and they laid him off in the early 90s, back when there was this sort of big recession back in the early 1990s. And he was laid off with like 60 other people, and he was the only one that they hired back later on. So it's like, gee, why him? You know, they hired him back, and he worked really hard and sort of went through a whole bunch of other layoffs. And at one point, he just threw his back out. And the poor guy at one point was just laying on his back for like 3 months at home because he couldn't even get out of bed because he had hurt his back so much. And the typical insurance company calls him up and says, well, you've got to go back to work because we're not going to cover you anymore. So this poor guy has to drag himself to the train with his bad back and sort of crawl into work for a long period of time. And his wife was telling me when we visited her that he was doing the work of four people because there was just all these rounds of layoffs and firings and sort of corporate takeovers, and he had so many bosses that she didn't even know the name of his supervisor. She was trying to contact them and get information. She didn't even know who he worked for, so that's how much was going on. And the last time I saw him was the end of June, July. He came down for my son's first birthday, and he just looked so tired and worn out, and he was just working really, really hard. He would get up at 6:30 in the morning, go to work, get home about 8 o'clock at night, have dinner, and then work until midnight from home, and then go back to work the next day. So I feel kind of sad that he was working so hard at the time and just doing so much work and probably was not getting the recognition or the financial rewards that deserved. And so I have a lot of regrets for him. I wish that he was happier, that he was doing something a little more satisfying, but that's just my opinion. So
now, in the days since this horrible event in New York and Washington, our government has begun a campaign of airstrikes in Afghanistan, where Al-Qaeda allegedly, you know, has their training camps. How do you feel about the response that our government is taking to this event?
Well, I think it just displays a tremendous lack of imagination, I think. The most obvious thing is just to, you know, drop as many tons of bombs as you can on somebody, and it's just this heavy-handed response. You've got to do something, I suppose, but I think what I wish had happened is that we tried to bring these people to justice, tried to bring them to the UN, tried to bring them to the World Court, and really scored a victory for democracy by saying, we're going to do this in a legal fashion, and we're going to bring these people in and try them and bring them to justice and put them in jail for the rest of their lives, or I guess the United States has the death penalty, you know, we'll do that. But at least there would have been some semblance of a trial. And the reason that we can't do that is because the United States has ignored every ruling that has ever taken place against it in the World Court and from the UN, we've ignored all of them, so we can't very well go to that same group and say, hey, we want to have a trial and bring this guy in, because it kind of makes us look bad. I mean, they would say, well, what about you? You're ignoring our rulings, so that's why we're not doing that. I just feel really sick with all the bombing, because I think it's civilians that are going to get hurt the most in this. And I was reading a book recently, and it had these statistics that said 3/4 of all deaths in wartime at the end of the 20th century were civilian deaths. They weren't even military deaths. So whenever there's this kind of operation where you're bombing from a great height and where things always go wrong, things, triggers are always going to go off or computers are going to malfunction, of course you're going to kill people. And that's exactly what's happened. You know, we're killing civilians. I think today we dropped a bomb on a hospital. And it's the people that are innocent that are getting hurt. And the Northern Alliance, I guess, who we're buddying up with to go in and get rid of the Taliban, is apparently, from what I've read, is even worse than the Taliban and is more repressive. So you have to ask, what are we doing exactly? Are we just throwing out a horrible regime, which, of course, everybody agrees they're a horrible regime, and replacing them with a worse regime? I don't think the bombing is really going to do any good, and I think it's just going to make people hate us even more and turn them against us, and that's a really dangerous part of the world. You know, there's atomic bombs over there, and there's all sorts of incredible long-standing tensions. You know, nobody asked me if it was okay to declare war. I don't remember my senator and representative talking at length about this and declaring war. So it's very odd that we're being told we're at war when legally I don't think we are. And I don't know if you've seen the evidence against Osama bin Laden. I think the only place I've actually seen it is on the Internet, on the Guardian website, the newspaper over in London. And they ran what Tony Blair had looked at, and it's completely circumstantial. It wouldn't hold up in court that this guy did it. I mean, he probably did, but you've got to obey the law here. So I think even President Bush has said that the evidence wouldn't hold up in court. So I think we really ought to ask ourselves, what are we doing here? We've given the CIA the okay to kill him, and based on what? Based on conjecture, basically.
In the days after October 7th is when the U.S. military campaign and the bombings started in Afghanistan. In the days right after that, immediately after that event, you wrote a story called I Lost My Brother on 9/11, Does He Matter? And it was published on alternet.org, which is a pretty good website for alternative viewpoints. In this, you ask a lot of important questions, and I'm wondering, first, what was it that made you speak out about your experiences and your views? And can you talk about, you know, mainstream media coverage that you've seen so far?
I wrote it because I turned on the radio and heard Cokie Roberts on NPR, and I just have this long-standing resentment of Cokie Roberts, who is on NPR, and I really have no idea why she's on NPR, because she's a right-wing, ultra-right-wing conservative Republican. And I guess NPR allegedly is a left-leaning or at least objective centrist network, and she is just so out of place there, and I just have never understood why she's on NPR and ABC, which clearly is not a left-wing company either. To answer your question, quite simply, I wrote it out of just sheer anger, because she had been asked this question the day after we had started bombing, and the Morning Edition host, Bob Edwards, said something like, leaders of Congress issued a statement in support of military action, and were there any dissenters? And she said, well, none that matter, you know, in her sort of patrician manner. And I just could not believe what I was hearing, that this sort of opinion was being passed off as mainstream reporting. And she just basically said that the people that matter are the ones who were voting for war, you know, and there were all these polls, and obviously everybody wants this, so the people that don't want it simply don't matter in the face of, you know, poll data or whatever. I was just angry, and I went online, and I just went to the NPR website and listened to it again just to make sure that I heard correctly and that I was accurate, and wrote this piece about how the news is framed. And I think the larger issue of it is that the media and the freedom of the press and who controls the media, I think, is just the central issue of our time. And I think unless we deal with that nothing is going to get better and nothing is going to change. And I think that ABC, NBC, CBS, they're obviously all owned by big corporations that are military subcontractors that have deep ties to war. So you have to ask the question, isn't it kind of a conflict of interest that you're promoting fear and terror on your network, and thus increasing the profits of your mother company. And I think this is an issue with everything, whether it's ABC, NBC, CBS, whether it's CNN, which is also tremendously kind to the Pentagon. And at one point, you probably remember, employed some CIA psychological ops people on their staff to sell people the Gulf War. And even the same thing with NPR, which is just getting more and more right-wing and less and less alternative. Public radio was chartered to be an alternative to commercial media. But that statement, "none that matter," just seemed to be such a judgmental statement, and she really did seem to be speaking for a class of people. And it really does seem to be sort of a class issue here. People like her, these multimillionaire news people who seem to be making judgments for the rest of us, and it really seems like we're the ones that are going to be doing the fighting, and we're the ones that are going to be doing the suffering and doing the dying. And so that statement just kind of grabbed me, and it seemed to apply to a lot of other things that I wrote about in this article. Just this kind of arrogant attitude of everyone in the government when it comes to all these other questions, whether it's the U.S. stance on eliminating the ABM treaty, or the Kyoto Summit saying that we weren't going to apply these standards to reducing emissions, and the idea that these criticisms of us don't matter, and that the concerns of the rest of the world has with us over these decisions don't matter. All those things seem to resonate with me, and that's why I wrote it. And it seems like it's gotten quite a lot of feedback. It's gotten picked up a lot, and I'd like to think, and I'm not sort of blowing my own horn here, but I just feel like I touched a nerve, and that a lot of people seem to be aware of the uniformity of the media in terms of covering either the war or the various other crises that have emerged, the anthrax thing. And I think we're not very well served by the media with that sort of monolithic, uniform coverage. I remember just last week looking at Alternet and some of the other, the Tom Paine website, I think it's tompaine.com, and reading all sorts of really interesting articles about the situation today, why we're there, and the need for oil, and the historical needs that we have with that region in terms of getting oil and getting energy. Lots of other interesting articles about what's going on in terms of civil liberties and all of these terrorism bill that's going through Congress, raising a lot of issues about that. And I felt like I was a pretty informed guy. And then I kind of sampled network news, turned on the TV, and all they were talking about was anthrax. It seemed as if that's all they were talking about for the whole week, you know? And so I feel like there's a lot that needs to be talked about, but I'm kind of disappointed with the level of discourse, and I feel like we really do need some serious reforms of the media before we can ever have freedom in this country. I think we really do need to get some hardworking journalism done and stop spending millions and millions of dollars on these star anchors like, take your pick, Peter Jennings or Tom Brokaw, who are all, I'm sure, very talented, wonderful people. But when you pay them millions and millions of dollars, you have to get rid of that many other actual reporters who are doing the work, and you have to take all that money from other people and give it to them, and I just think it's a bad way to go. So that's kind of a long answer to your question, I guess.
As a relative of somebody who was lost on 9/11, do you find that your views are welcome on mainstream media? Are you being asked to do interviews?
Oh, not at all. I mean, no. No, not at all. I mean, I've had some phone calls from, like, the Village Voice in New York. I think somebody interviewed me from there, and somebody from the Seattle Intelligencer got some comments from me. But I don't know that you would call those mainstream media. But also, I'm not, I guess my story is not necessarily the most dramatic or the most compelling story, because I didn't lose a spouse. I didn't lose my child or something like that. I mean, it was a brother, and obviously he was important to me, but I'm sure there are a lot worse stories than mine, so it may just be that I'm kind of lost in the shuffle here.
Well, we pretty much covered all the questions I had, so I'm just going to leave it up to you if you want to leave us with any comments, any final parting thoughts, things that we haven't talked about, some experiences you might want to let our listeners know about.
You know, now we're starting to feel kind of depressed, you know, me and the rest of my family. We're really trying to feel it now. But I was really sad even before this happened. I was really sad just at how mean we are to each other, not only to the rest of the world, but to each other. And I just feel like we are such a cruel country, the way we treat each other with the death penalty in this country, the fact that there's 40 million Americans without health care, there's 30 million children living in poverty, the way that we crack down on dissent, which is supposed to be legal in this country, and the whole prison system. And I feel like this event on 9/11 really shows us that we're all connected, and all these issues are connected, and all these people that are out on the street, whether they're protesting the WTO or whatever, that all of these issues are related, you know, the political issues, the economic issues, the education, healthcare, living wage, all these things come together in this event. And I think, if anything, it just reminds me, and I hope it reminds you, that we're all human beings, and we're all equal, and we're all brothers and sisters, and in a sad way, we're all victims of this event, and we're also victims of this war. And I hope we can see some solidarity there as human beings and as the people who are going to do most of the dying here. I think I mentioned before there's some statistic that says that 3/4 of deaths in wartime now are civilians. They're not soldiers. We're the ones that are going to suffer for this, and other people just like us around the world are the ones that are going to be doing most of the dying and most of the suffering. So I hope we can think about those people over there and just realize that they're just like us, and they have the same needs and the same desires and the same children as we do. I was watching some special, I think it was a Frontline special on PBS the other night, and it showed these poor Afghan refugees just fleeing Afghanistan, you know, these poor people on donkeys while we're dropping these megatonnage of bombs on these people. And there was some little kid in one of the pictures that looked just like my baby. And I thought, man, here I am sitting here with my wife and my kid, and we're eating ice cream, watching this on TV, and there's this little boy over there that's just like my little boy, and it's so sad what we're doing to him and what we're doing to them. And it's, they don't deserve it, we don't deserve it. And I think we deserve better as people. We deserve better from our government. We deserve more solutions, better solutions, and a lot more imagination from our government in this regard. And I think there's a better way of dealing with this and a better way of handling it. So I hope we feel some solidarity with other people, and I hope that we can constructively let our government know that there's got to be a better way than just dropping bombs. There's got to be a better way of doing this, and that's what I hope comes out of this.
That was freelance reporter David Pottorti. You can read his article titled, I Lost My Brother on 9/11. Does He Matter? It's on the web at www.alternet.org. You're tuned to the Weekly Freak Show.
I know you can remember you of this present race. But watch the killing fields. Watch the poison pills. And watch how we killed our young. And you'll be drafted. They'll ask you to serve. They'll twist you inside you. This oil machine, they're gonna start a war. They're gonna start a war. Right to your
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, you're tuned to the Weekly Freak Show on Party Town Radio, webcasting to the world at www.partytown.com/radio. Please have a pen and paper ready to take down our contact info at the end of this one-hour broadcast. That was Astro Sonics with this week's Spotlight Sound, War in Colombia, available for download on mp3.com. The Associated Press reports this week that the United States will provide Colombia with counter-terrorist aid, in addition to military aid, to fight drug trafficking as part of the new global war on terrorism. The U.S. ambassador to Colombia announced this Friday. Washington plans to train and equip elite anti-kidnapping and bomb squads, assist civilian and military counter-terrorism terror investigators and help Colombia guard its oil pipelines from real bomb attacks. The Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Public Studies in Washington, D.C., seeks to promote holistic alternatives that address race and poverty as an integral element of drug policy. Internationally, the project examines the social impact of exporting the U.S. drug war overseas. From military counter-narcotics aid for repressive regimes to the environmental devastation caused by eradication and fumigation policies, the project highlights the consequences of such programs on the poor and disenfranchised. The project's mission is to help foster a paradigm shift by replacing the punitive and coercive social control models of drug policy with a public health and community economic development model. Sanho Tri is the director of the Drug Policy Project. He has worked as a military and diplomatic historian and co-authored The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb and the Architecture of an American Myth. Sanho Tri is pursuing drug policy reform by reaching out to non-traditional allies and employing innovative tactics to promote a sustainable, constitutional, and humane drug control policy. He spoke in Santa Cruz on Thursday, October 25th. In his talk, he addresses the similarities between the war on drugs in Colombia and the new war on terrorism.
Colombia is mired in a nearly four-decade-old civil war. It's the most current civil war. They've had a long series of internal conflicts since independence from Spain. The civil war right now is being fought by two rebel groups, a right-wing paramilitary death squad, which is allied with the Colombian military. It's the Colombian military that we are supporting now to the tune of $1.3 billion of mostly militarized aid that Congress appropriated last year. All sides in the conflict down there have been involved in the drug economy. We hear a lot in the United States about the guerrillas, particularly the FARC, the FARC. It's the largest guerrilla group. They are using the coca fields where we get the coca plants, is where we get the cocaine from, and they're taxing these peasant farmers who are growing the coca leaf and using that to raise money to fight their war. All sides in this conflict have been involved in this drug economy, so that the right-wing paramilitary death squads, who are responsible for almost three-quarters of the atrocities committed in this war, it's a very, very brutal war, primarily civilian massacres, by the way, they are even more deeply involved in the drug trade in terms of not only taxing, but growing and refining the cocaine and smuggling it out at all levels of that drug economy. The Colombian military and the Colombian government have at times also been heavily corrupted by drug money. You've heard of the Cali cartel, the Medellin cartel. The Colombians had something they called the Blue Cartel, blue being the color of the Air Force. It doesn't stop there. Drugs are an equal opportunity corrupter, so that it even reached into the U.S. Embassy. Last year, Colonel James Hite, our military chief of counter-narcotics down there in the embassy, was convicted of money laundering. His wife had been using the embassy diplomatic pouch to smuggle heroin back to New York, and he was helping her launder the money. And this is our top military person down there in charge of fighting the drug war. Some of you here are old enough to remember prohibition of alcohol and the corrupting influences that had on law enforcement. And it hasn't changed much, unfortunately. And I would argue that that is a function of the prohibition economy. And that's something that I really want to focus on. There are many policymakers who say drugs fund terrorism. So people who buy drugs are actually funding terrorism. Well, actually, drugs don't fund terrorism any more than wheat or corn or any other agricultural commodity funds terrorism. It's drug prohibition that funds terrorism, because we're talking about minimally processed agricultural commodities that really aren't worth a whole lot. The international drug economy is something that's fueled by three major factors that we don't take too seriously here in the United States, certainly not in the U.S. Congress. The first is extreme poverty in drug-producing countries. Countries like Afghanistan, like rural Colombia, like many other places. According to the United Nations Development Program and also to the World Bank, they both estimate that there are approximately 1.2 billion people in the world who live on less than $1 a day. So if you bought a soda in a vending machine today, chances are you've blown your daily allotment of money. Imagine paying for the roof over your head, food, clothing, children's education, all of these things on a dollar a day. To put it another way, there are 2.8 billion people in the world who live on less than $2 a day. That's a lot of poverty. And these are people who really don't have much to lose and are prepared to take whatever risks are necessary in order to survive. very often the choice is between poverty and starvation, and they're choosing poverty. And these people happen to live, many of them happen to live in zones, in areas, where you can put a seed into the ground and grow an illicit crop that will sustain them. They won't profit from it. They won't get rich. It's not easy money, but it's a way of subsisting. It's a very minimal existence. I was in Colombia earlier this year, in southern Colombia, a province called Putumayo, which is Spanish for Vietnam. No, it's the epicenter of U.S. policy in Colombia, where the rebels are particularly strong there, and a lot of the coca is being grown. But the poverty down there, the level of abandonment by the state, by the Colombian government, and indeed most of the Colombian countryside has been abandoned by the state. It's a 75% urban population, and so they really haven't invested in the rural areas. When you come across that kind of poverty, no roads, no electricity, no running water, no infrastructure of any sort, people do what it takes to survive. And you see that around the world. Now, that was the first factor, extreme poverty. The second factor we don't take too seriously in this country is undiminished demand. That is to say that we do not fund universal treatment on request in this country. Congress authorized it in 1988, but they never got around to appropriating the money for it. It's very easy to authorize things. You can say you're in favor of this, that, or the other. We're in favor of world peace. You just don't have to do anything about it. Such that addicts who want to get off drugs, I'm not even talking about the ones who are caught by the police and sentenced by a judge in a drug court to get mandatory treatment. I'm talking about people who voluntarily come into a public treatment facility and say, I've had enough. I want to get off these drugs. Please help me, but I can't do it myself. I'm, by definition, an addict. And wherever I go around the country to speak, it's the same situation I keep running into, both in urban areas and rural areas. The treatment lines are very, very long. We simply don't have money for that, such that people are told, come back 4, 5, 6 months later. Perhaps we'll have a treatment slot open for you then. But if you don't give people treatment when they want it, chances are you've lost that opportunity. They may have gone back to using, probably, because they're by definition addicted. And so it makes no sense to turn these people away and fund a supply-side strategy that is the least cost-effective means of reducing drug use in the United States. The RAND Corporation, not exactly a liberal think tank. People remember from the Vietnam War, they did a lot of the strategic bombing policies and nuclear targeting policies. They were commissioned by the U.S. Army and by the Drug Czar's office a couple of years ago to do a study on controlling cocaine. And one of the questions they asked was a very simple goal. What would it take to reduce U.S. cocaine consumption by just 1%? It's a very modest objective. When they looked at all the different policy options and they crunched all the numbers, they found that dollar for dollar, it was 23 times more effective to fund drug treatment in the United States to addicts than it was to try to chase drugs around in the source countries. So we're actually following the least cost-effective means of reducing drug use, if that is indeed what we're concerned about. So we have extreme poverty, we have undiminished demand, and the third factor is the artificial escalation of the value of these basically worthless weeds. When we talk about things like marijuana, coca, poppy, these are weeds. They've grown wild for millions of years. They grow better with agricultural inputs, fertilizers, pesticides, etc., but they'll grow wild perfectly fine. You know, the alchemists of the Middle Ages tried for centuries to look for a formula to turn lead into gold, and they never succeeded. It took the U.S. Congress to figure out how to do that. We have a policy, I mean, it's sad, it's true, though, but we have a policy that turns essentially worthless weeds and seeds into gold. Marijuana, ounce for ounce, can be worth its weight in gold. If it's high-potency marijuana, sometimes twice its weight in gold. It's a weed, ditch weed, hemp. When we're talking about things like cocaine and heroin, they're worth many, many, many times their weight in gold. So that when you put such extreme poverty next to such extreme profits, and that's not to say the peasant farmers are the ones making the money off of this, far from it. It's the middlemen and the people involved in the higher levels of the drug economy that are making the money. But when you put that much poverty next to this much profit, you've got an unstoppable force. If you can buy a kilo of pure cocaine in the streets of Colombia for $1,500, and by the time you cut it up into the gram level and dilute it and sell it on the streets in little packages in the United States, it can fetch $150,000. You know, this commodity is going to move in that direction. Again, we're talking about minimally processed agricultural commodities. They really shouldn't be worth that much. So it's our policies that give these things so much value. To draw an example closer to home, Al Capone and his gangster buddies weren't, you know, shooting each other with machine guns because they were drunk on alcohol. They were shooting each other because of the profits to be made off of alcohol prohibition. So it's the profits in this economy that are responsible for much of the violence that we associate with the drug economy. So, and the best that we've ever been able to do from a demand side is basically push drug cultivation, illicit crop cultivation, from one region to the next, one country to the next, and indeed from one continent to the next. People call it the balloon effect. You know, if you squeeze on one end of the balloon, the other end expands. Senator Ted Stevens coined a phrase for it last year. He called it whack-a-mole, the boardwalk game where you beat the mole down in the little hole and it pops up the other hole and you keep chasing it around. That's what we've been doing with source country policies, trying to eradicate drugs at the source. People think of coca, where we get cocaine from, as an Andean phenomenon. They associate it with Bolivia, the mountainsides. It grows in, you know, high altitudes. In fact, there are varieties of coca that will grow in many different types of soil. Basically, if it doesn't freeze, coca can survive. It will live on jungle floors. It'll grow in the United States. I know someone who grew it in San Francisco in the 70s, who's a botanist. There are plots of coca in Hawaii for research purposes. Before World War II, Indonesia was a major exporter of cocaine. So this stuff will grow in many different places. Similarly, opium poppies will grow in all 50 states, as will marijuana. And I think that's one of the reasons why, after pouring billions and billions of dollars down the drug war drain, we're doing worse than ever. If you look at the government's own indicators of success or failure, price, purity, availability, overdose deaths, those are at record levels of failure or near record levels of failure. Drugs are cheaper than ever before, more available, more pure. Record overdose deaths or near record levels, those are the kinds of indicators that are more objective. And the government's own studies show that these are at very poor levels. So elected officials want to get tough when they see lawlessness. They want to escalate law enforcement. So we get this Darwinian evolution of this economy. Let me give you some concrete examples. Back in the 1970s, the main illicit export from Colombia was not cocaine. It was not heroin. It was marijuana. And so when Ronald Reagan came in, he brought in the military into South Florida, tried to cut off that flow of marijuana. And the Colombian smugglers realized, well, you know, hey, we have something else here that's a lot more profitable, a lot more compact. The dogs don't know how to sniff for this stuff yet. It's not big and bulky and smelly like these giant bales of marijuana. You could smuggle it with tourists in briefcases. It's addictive to a lot of people. And that, of course, was cocaine. And so the war on marijuana led in part to the cocaine explosion in the 1980s. And meanwhile, the dreaded marijuana we were trying to stop from Colombia, I don't need to tell people in this part of the country what happened. It became homegrown, right? It's a huge industry in the United States now. You've all probably heard of the Medellin cartel, the Cali cartel, the dreaded cocaine cartels. Well, the United States helped the Colombians break up those cartels. Did the problem go away? Obviously not. It became worse than ever, to the point where the drugs are threatened, Colombia would collapse unless we helped them fight the drug war. That so much drugs were coming out of Colombia that it was overwhelming our ability to do anything about it. The U.S. Congress likes to claim they're going to democratize things. We're going to democratize Cuba. We're going to democratize Nicaragua. I would argue that the only thing we've successfully democratized in Latin America is the drug economy itself. We took out the two big monopolies, and we opened up that space to hundreds of smaller competitors, some of them family-operated, vertically integrated, much more efficient, each with their own smuggling routes, their own list of officials that they bribe, much harder to infiltrate. We made the problem much worse. So again, we see this escalation of the drug war leading to the opposite effect, and that's a function, again, of the prohibition economy. The other contradiction here is that we've applied a war paradigm to the drug problem. And in my opinion, drugs are a public health problem, one that has social and economic consequences, but it's a public health issue, not a criminal justice issue, not a military issue. I worked for several years as a military and diplomatic historian, and I studied how countries get into wars, how they get out. One thing I learned is that wars are about employing brute force to extract a political concession, a capitulation from a rational state actor. That is to say, you want to use your forces to get the other country to bend to your will, to surrender. The problem is that we're applying this paradigm to a plant, weeds and seeds. You know, a coca seed doesn't sit in the ground and think to itself and calculate, well, what are the chances that the U.S. Congress is going to pass a law and fumigation planes will come and spray me? Or what are my prices today in the open market? Should I wait in the ground here for a few more months before it's more profitable and then I'll sprout? Plants are not rational actors. The problem, however, is that around these plants, around these basically worthless weeds, millions of people around the world have latched onto it because our policies of prohibition give it so much wealth. So that all of these individual actors, and we're talking about individual actors, not armies, you know, not nation states. We're talking about individual peasant farmers in southern Colombia or Afghanistan. We're talking about the lawyer in Midtown Manhattan that snorts cocaine, the guy in the street corner selling crack, the high school kid in the suburban high school dealing marijuana out of the school bathroom. All of these individuals participate in the drug economy because they think they'll get away with it. And by and large, they do. And so you'll never get an organized surrender, a coherent capitulation from all of these individual actors all over the globe. So if there's no surrender, when does the war end? This is by definition a forever war. There is no end game. And that's something else that worries me tremendously about our involvement in Colombia, which is that we're getting sucked into a four-decade-old civil war. We tend to be supporting one side in that civil war. And it's a war that neither side can win. But more importantly, we don't know how we're going to get out. Getting in is easy. You get some members of Congress who pound the table and say, I got to get tough. We got to go out and clean them out and take care of this problem. It's easy for hotheads to get into these kinds of wars. It's a little bit harder to get out, especially since, once again, we don't have an end game. We don't have an exit strategy. How do you define victory in this war? Is it when we've wiped out 20% of the coca crops or 50% or 100%? Is the war finally over when U.S. citizens stop using drugs altogether? Is that when we get to declare victory and go home? Keep in mind, we can't even keep drugs out of our own prisons where we're supposed to have total control, but somehow we're going to miraculously get rid of drugs in Latin America. Just to give you some idea of the kind of disconnect we're talking about here between Congress and reality, the House of Representatives in 1998 passed the Western Hemisphere Drug Elimination Act. I think the target date was 2003 or 2002. I don't think we're going to make it. The Senate tried to pick up a counterpart, the Drug-Free Century Act for the 21st century. This is the kind of fantasy dialogue we're having on Capitol Hill. So again, you know, we'll never get to zero coca. So what are the other policy objectives? What are some other indicators of victory? Are we there to push the guerrillas south of the equator? Are we trying to degrade their military capability, as in Kosovo? Is there a river we need to cross, a mountaintop, a hill to seize? Is there an enemy flag to take down? Is there a capital city? No one's willing to say what victory will look like. So if we don't know what victory looks like, do we know what defeat looks like? Because I would argue that we've been staring at it for years now. The more money we've put into this drug war, the worse we're losing. And we've talked about some of the dynamics of why that tends to happen. And we've been neglecting the one policy alternative that has been proven to work, which is treatment. Our drug war budget, when Ronald Reagan came into office, was less than $1 billion at the federal level. Now it's almost $20 billion. And the results are worse than ever. And that budget, two-thirds of that goes to supply side, law enforcement, eradication, getting tough approaches. Less than a third goes to treatment and prevention and things that might actually have a chance of doing some good. But, you know, treatment will only get you so far. It will make things much better. It will help things a great deal. But ultimately, we have to build a healthier society. Americans self-medicate at alarmingly high levels. That's very disproportionate with other countries. And we have to ask why that is. When I first started doing work in drug policy, I spent some time in East Baltimore trying to work with communities on the front lines of the drug war. I mean, truly one of the really sad, sad scenes you'll come across. And I would come across addicts who were so drugged out, you know, they could barely stand up. They couldn't tell you what day of the week it was or who the president was. There's some doubt about who that might be, but that's another matter. Trick question, I'm sorry. But my point is that many of these people were products of failed educational systems, crumbling schools with no educational skills under their belt, no job skills, no job training programs, no jobs in their communities. People, you know, without hope, without future, people for whom tomorrow is not going to be a better day. That's the most dangerous thing. That's the worst thing that can confront us. Because there you'll also see, you know, some people choose to self-medicate in the face of that. Others choose to pick up arms and start an insurgency. Still others might resort to terrorism. I used to listen to Jesse Jackson's speeches, and they were great speeches, right? But at the end, he would always chant, "Keep hope alive, keep hope alive." And I always thought that was kind of corny until I met people who didn't have hope. And then you really know what that means. And that's I can't stress that enough. If you contrast our drug policies with, say, the Netherlands, Amsterdam, you know, our drug warriors like to ridicule Amsterdam. You can buy marijuana hashish in so-called coffee shops. But in fact, in the Netherlands, they have much lower rates of drug use across the board, including rates of marijuana use among teens compared to the U.S. In the Netherlands, in Amsterdam, you have to work pretty hard to fall between the cracks. They have a very good social safety net. Your housing, your education, medical care, you know, most of these things are either subsidized or taken care of by the state. In the United States, you don't have to work hard at all to fall between the cracks. A lot of folks are two paychecks away from being homeless. Go to any inner city or rural area and you'll see what I'm talking about. And in the face of that, you know, people may tend to self-medicate or reach for whatever helps them get through the day. I don't think it's any coincidence that liquor companies target malt liquor to areas where heroin might be popular. They're similar in many ways. They know there's a market there for that. I think if we want to have a war against anything, it ought to be against what I call the PDA problem. Poverty, despair, alienation. Those are at the roots of so many of the problems that we confront. And if we focused our attentions on those problems, we would solve a whole host of other social ills, not just drugs, but terrorism and other things as well. That is to say that I think, you know, drugs and the drug problem is a manifestation of other social ills. It's a symptom. And our policies have been basically to punish that symptom, to try to make it go away without looking at the root causes. And coercion is not something that has proven to work very well. Countries like Iran, which have very harsh, draconian, liberal use of the death penalty for some drug offenses, still have 2 million drug addicts. So maybe there is some level of coercion that will make this problem disappear. But I don't think any of us would want to live in that kind of a society. Think to the right of Iran. The international war on terrorism, there are a lot of parallels between the approach taken to that and the approach taken to the drug war. And that's something that we need to pay really close attention to, I think. Because they're both problems that if you attack with conventional methods will make the problem worse. We've talked about the drug war and why escalating law enforcement tends to make that problem worse. With terrorism, in the case of September 11th, how do you coerce someone who isn't afraid to die? You know, do you threaten to kill them? It's not working. It tends to get them angrier, and it tends to exacerbate, and it tends to recruit other people who might be sitting on the fence, who are angry but haven't gotten that angry yet. Of all the laws that Congress can pass or repeal, you know, there are a couple of basic ones that they can't do anything about. One's the law of evolution, the evolution of these markets. The other law is the law of supply and demand. Our drug policy is one that it's like building an agricultural irrigation system based on the idea that water will flow uphill. You know, that's what we're doing with our drug policy. And the third law is the law of unintended consequences. So the politicians who want to crack down and look tough and prosecutors who want to run for election by prosecuting lots of drug dealers, there are consequences for those kinds of policies. There are, you know, other similarities with the drug war and the war on terror. The root causes, I mean, I know it's unfashionable now to talk about root causes. The conservatives will jump all over you and say, well, if you get mugged on the street, do you really want to look into the childhood of the mugger to figure out where he went wrong? Or do you want cops there to protect you and prosecutors to put that person away? I think root causes are really important. Conservatives like to say, well, you can't throw money at these problems, at social problems. It just doesn't work. Well, in fact, they throw money at problems all the time. Imagine Congress appropriating 3/4 of the money necessary to build a fighter plane. You know, sorry, times are tough. We don't have enough money to finish the tail part of the plane. So we'll give you 3/4 of it. People would say, that's insane. That'll never work. The plane will never fly. It's a waste of money. And yet we do that all the time with things like alternative economic development for drug-producing areas, like social programs at home, treatment, welfare, trying to take care of those basic problems. The conservatives say, well, you can't throw money at the problem. And so we give it a tiny fraction of the funding, and then they turn around and say, you see, it doesn't work. You can't throw money at a problem. Unless, of course, the problem happens to be Star Wars. Then you keep throwing money at it until it does work. And if it doesn't work, then we'll throw gold coins at the incoming missiles. Even better if it doesn't work. You keep throwing money into the military-industrial complex and your contributors. One of the other problems that plagues us with terrorism is that people have resorted to what's called asymmetrical warfare. That is to say, in the old days, I would have an army, you would have an army, I would have a navy, you have a navy, and we go at each other. We fight it out. But if I'm the last superpower, if I am the hegemonic paramount power in the world, and you're angry, disenfranchised, and you can't possibly compete with me, and you can't spend your way to throw up a $100 billion missile shield or whatever, B-2 bombers, then what do? People, exactly, terrorism. People try to even the playing field to find out where your vulnerabilities are, like the World Trade Center. like our reservoirs, our dams, our infrastructure, our postal system. It's hard to call yourself a superpower if you can't protect your own capital. But one response to that from Congress has been not unlike the drug war. We need to throw more money into this. We need to have a stronger military. We need to make ourselves even more strong, as if throwing more money at defense will make us more safe. But in fact, that in many ways exacerbates the reasons why people choose asymmetrical warfare. So if we make ourselves more invulnerable, or we think we're making ourselves more invulnerable, it may cause people who are frustrated to find more ways to reach out and level that playing field. And then finally, we need to look at another parallel between the drug war and the war on terrorism, and that is dehumanization. The way we dehumanize drug users, drug producers, peasants who grow these drugs, these narco-peasants. Think about the language that we use, crackhead, junkie, as though these people were disposable. We've dehumanized them. We don't realize that they're part of us, they're our society, members of our family. So we know about that side of dehumanization. We've done it very effectively. The other side of this, you know, many people have said, well, how can people fly a plane into a building full of civilians? They have dehumanized the people in the World Trade Center. It wasn't people who have wronged them personally, but it was them. They are Americans. They are bad. We're going to go after them. They blame us for their problems. We have to look and see that that's also something that we're capable of doing. Not in the same way, but we also dehumanize. We also give our allegiance arbitrarily to a lot of different things. We get it from day one, from the day we're born. I was brought up in Washington, D.C. in the suburbs. I'm supposed to support the Washington Redskins. I don't know why. I can't figure it out. I don't know what they stand for, what makes them different than the Cowboys or whoever, but somehow if I say something bad about the Skins in D.C., boy, you could start a fight. You've heard about soccer hooligans in England, people who've killed people over different sports teams. We have to look at, you know, how it is that we choose our allegiances and why. And just to bring that to kind of a more lethal level, we have, and I don't want this to be misinterpreted, I'm not trying to denigrate the United States or people who've defended the United States, but if you look at boot camp, the military, how many people have been through boot camp? What's the first thing they did to you? Took everything away, exactly. Anything that gave you an identity was taken away from you. You were dehumanized, stripped down, so that you could be rebuilt as a soldier, to do things that aren't necessarily natural for human beings to do. And I'm not singling out the United States military by any means. Please don't misinterpret this. All militaries do this. I mean, it's you can't have a military without it. But to condition an 18-year-old to kill someone they've never met, can't judge, who you don't know their history, their hopes, their dreams, their aspirations, their sorrows, you don't know their families, you don't know anything about them, but to be able to pull a trigger and terminate that life out of reflex takes a lot of conditioning. It's a very unnatural thing. Simply because they're wearing the wrong clothes that day, the wrong uniform. We have to look at how we give our allegiances, how we act ourselves as well. A good friend of mine, who I've recently met in the past 2 years, one of the nicest people you ever meet, but his job a little over a decade ago was to sit hundreds of feet underground in North Dakota in a missile silo to be prepared to turn the key to push the button and snuff out millions of lives, people he's never met. I'm not in any way justifying what happened at the World Trade Center or anything like that, but we need to think a little bit more deeply about these issues. And so we need to rehumanize ourselves and each other. So we're not going after them, we're going after people. I think I'll wrap it up there.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening. The Weekly Freak Show is produced live in the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, and can also be heard on Micropower 102.9 FM in Dade City, Florida. The features in this program are only a sample of the fine shows each week on Freak Radio. To hear it all, 24 hours a day, listen online at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. For questions and comments, send email to FRSC@microradio.net. That's FRSC@microradio.net or snail mail to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. That's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. Or call 831-427-4523. That's 831-427-4523. Thanks to the A Infos Radio Project for distribution. Our theme music was arranged and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. For everyone here at Freak Radio, my name's V-Man, and that's a wrap.